Let's see if we can finish chapter 1:18 through 3:20. There's a term, and here's one of the second discussions that I want to make sure we're aware of when we go into Romans. It's perhaps a little bit deeper than some people are concerned about, and it has to be, what is Paul's view of what he's trying to describe? What's the view of Judaism at the time? And it comes under the term, the works of law. And so there are several ways to describe this. The best way is to have a visual illustration as well of what's taking place. When you talk about Judaism, you talk about religion, you talk about Christianity, there's this entity we call God. And there's an entity called humanity. And when you talk about religion in general, or Christianity, Judaism in particular, there is an attempt by humanity to enter into a relationship with that God. Gods in other religions at times that are not monotheistic. The question is, how does one enter into the relationship between humanity and God? The first issue is called legalism. We're going to bracket that out as the relationship. So, legalism says that I have the law. If I keep the law and obey the law, then I will be in this relationship with God. Paul describes that in chapter 2, right? He says, if you do the law, you'll be justified. That's one view. But what does he say about that? Nobody can do that. His conclusion, chapter 3, is nobody can do that. And so, in modern language, by your works you're saved, by the things that you do, you have a tally and you add them up at the end of the world, at the end of time, and boom, you got enough to get in. Kind of like a grade in class. You get enough to get by. Well, Paul says nobody can pass if that's the situation. And most scholars will say, yep, legalism is not what Judaism was about. Sometimes people get the perspective it was legalistic. We just did this and we got that. And most scholars say, no, that's not what Judaism was about. And so there's another perspective. It is called covenantal gnomism. Covenant, very important language. Gnomism is a Greek word meaning law. And so keeping the law within a covenant. Many people describe Judaism of the first century that Paul would have been familiar with as covenantal gnomism. They entered a covenant, in fact, several covenants. There was a covenant with Abraham, with Moses, with David, with others who followed that. Several covenants were made, and so they entered into this covenant. Because they were in the covenant, they kept the law out of gratitude. And so covenantal gnomism says God initiates the relationship. We don't have to try and get God's approval. God initiated the relationship, which the Old Testament says happened in Genesis chapter 12, if you don't want to go back to Genesis chapter 1 to creation. And so one does good things to show God that you're thankful and appreciate His covenant. Well, the difficulty is, one still has to do what? Obey the law. What's Paul say about humanity's ability to obey the law? No one can do that. And so, you have these two terms, and Paul said, basically, neither one works. You can't keep the law enough to be in relationship with God. You can't keep the law enough once you're in relationship with God to have God always look favorably upon you. So what's the third alternative? Is there one? Because if there's not, we're just stuck in the mud with no way to get out. And so there is a third term that is used to describe what Paul is trying to accomplish. And it's called covenant piety or covenantal piety. Right? Still in covenant. It recognizes that God begins this relationship. But what happens is, Paul says the only way that the law can be kept is if God actually does that. Since humanity is impossible to do, only if God is doing it for humanity can that take place. And the word piety is a word that would have been very common in the first century. It's a Latin word, actually. It's not Greek. It's Latin, pious. And so the emperor going to the temple was pious. We wouldn't think that was pious today because piety has come to be some sort of Christian symbol. But piety is simply proper religious behavior. And Paul says it's not possible for us to do this. Why is it not possible? And he now enters a concept that we will talk about again and again and again and again and again, trying to get a grasp of what Paul means by this term. Sin. Sin is a religious category. It is something to do with religion. It is not a moral category. Okay? Which has something to do with what happens. We're going to get this all up here, okay? The problem is that when we think about sin hermeneutically, in our day, sin is a moral category. We think about sin as something we do wrong. We think about sin as small s, which then becomes plural. In other words, to go back to our example of impurity, which is the consequence of idolatry, which is the demonstration that the wrath of God exists, homosexuality. So people in 2009 will say people who engage, male and female, who engage in homosexual actions engage in sin. It is a sin to do that. That is a moral category. They also say people who gamble engage in a sin. People who did it, this. And there is a list that people have created of what a sin is. So sin becomes a general term that describes a host of things that are vices. Remember Philo's list of vices? Lengthy. And then we assume, because that's how we understand this word, that every time I hear the word in Romans, that's what Paul meant. But the question is, what did the text mean? The term for that is what? Exegesis. What did it mean for Paul? And for Paul, this term sin is like a proper name. It is a religious category. It is encompassing lots of things, but is defined by nothing. You can't say, well, that's sin and this is sin. It's just sin is. It exists. And so when Paul talks about this term, he is talking about either this relationship with God or the lack thereof. The lack thereof, he calls this. It's a religious category. You are either doing good deeds, and it's a biblical phrase, combined together, good deeds, one word, or bad deeds, one word. Good is not an adjective that modifies deeds, and bad is not an adjective that modifies deeds. You can define it. It is, you're doing good or you're doing bad. You do good stuff or bad stuff. You don't define what someone does and call it bad or good. So I can't say that people who choose to wear their hats are doing good because they want to hide their bad hair or whatever. I can't say that people who choose to wear shorts and flip-flops because it was 75 yesterday and it's February, are doing good. And I wouldn't. I'd say they're doing bad. But sin is not a list of things that are vices. Because if sin is a list of things that are vices, then the relationship with God becomes a list of things that are virtues. And if we only do the virtues all the time, then we can earn this relationship with God through legalism. Or covenantal gnomism. Both of which Paul says what?
You can't do.
You cannot enter into this relationship that God wants by anything you do, because no one is able to do 100% of the law 100% of the time. They're only able to do that as God makes it happen. And so, as we talk about this word, sin, it's important, if we're going to understand Romans, that we don't think of, oh, lying, cheating, swearing, playing cards, dancing, chewing, not gum, smoking, drinking. Take your pick. It's not a list of things that you define. It is a category. And the way he uses it, at the very end, he says, in 3:20, no human being will be justified, made righteous by his sight, because everyone, in verse 9 actually, is under the power of sin. And so that sin becomes this issue that has power. What else has power? The gospel has power. And you have this now contrast. And that's where Paul is wanting to talk about the good news. So, we're going to discuss sin quite frequently, and so you might want to make certain that as we talk about it, we try to get it right. So, that gets us out of 1:18 through 3:20, which is the antithesis.
All of that was the antithesis.
All of that's the antithesis.
And everything before that is the thesis.
Well, you have one. So far, we've just had one word of the thesis, two lines.
Yeah.
I'm not ashamed of thee, because it is the of God for, and then it goes on, right? And he has this thesis, which he states. He then has an antithesis. Not only is the wrath of God revealed, but all humanity is under sin's power. Now, does that sound like good news to you?
No.
That all humanity is under sin's power? Paul wants to go around telling everybody, you're under sin's power. And yet, how many people say that's what Romans is about? Telling people how bad they are. It's not what Paul wants to do. Because we don't understand how Paul argued in the year 58 when he wrote this letter. We assume he wrote the letter in 1958. Just like any other American would have in 1958. In a nice linear fashion where you make point A, you have point B, point C, and point D, and all points are equal and build upon one another. We don't understand thesis and antithesis. So, he made some questions, he answered some arguments, and now he wants to go back to his thesis. I'm not ashamed of the gospel. The power of God is revealed. The righteousness of God is revealed through faith. So he's described that it's impossible for humans to achieve this. So how's it going to happen? Now, you may have noticed. Let's go back here so you do notice. We're only dealing with 10 verses. 21 through 31. How many verses did we deal with in the last section?
Chapters.
There were chapters, right? If we're going to take 3 days to deal with 10 verses, what does that tell you about the importance of those 10 verses to the argument of Paul? Very. And I'll tell you right now that the midterm question that you have to write, and I'll give it to you a week ahead of time anyway, is describe the argument of Paul. And because we've dealt with these chapters for 3 days, people will spend a long time talking about the wrath of God. And they'll skip over 21 through 31 because it's only 10 verses. But which is more important to his argument? And people will write and write and write starting at the first and run out of time at the end. And they'll just shortchange the parts of his argument that are important. Is 118 through 320 really important to Paul's argument? No, it's not. All that does is prove that he has a reason to talk. There is good news. Why? Because humanity's under power, sin's power. There is good news. Why? Because nobody can have a relationship with God unless God does it himself. There is good news. Why? Well, because this. 118 through 320 is to try and prove to his opponents that, hey, there's a reason for good news because there's bad news. So we have the thesis, we have the antithesis, and we have now returning to the thesis, in which case he is going to unpack it. Because really, I mean, 1:16-17, I'm not ashamed of thee, because it is the of God for... What does that say? Not much. What does it mean? Not a clue. So at some point in the letter, Paul has to explain what he means by his thesis. He's going to start doing that now. He's going to continue doing that through chapter 6. And then he's going to take some more objections and then continue in chapter 8 and 9 to talk about his thesis. So, he's going to emphasize at this point the power of God. Why? Because humanity is under the power of sin. So, major points of his section. Sometimes I hope that people know a little bit about English when I teach this class. The word subject is a tense from English, is a term from English grammar. That means what? The one doing the action. Right? Got it? God is a subject means God is the one doing the action. That's consistent with covenantal piety. We read 21 through 26. Apart from the law, the righteousness of God has been disclosed, as testified by the law and the prophets, the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe. For there is no distinction, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. They are now justified by God's grace through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God put forward as a sacrifice of atonement by God's blood, Jesus' blood, actually, there, effecting through faith. God did this to show God's righteousness, because in God's divine forbearance, God passed over the sins previously committed. This proved at the present time that God was righteous, and God justifies the one who has faith in Jesus. Who's it talking about? Did you get it? Right? I'm not ashamed of the gospel because of the power of God. The specific God in the Jewish concept. He has a name called Yahweh. Has a four-letter word called the Tetragrammaton. All sorts of fun things we could tell you about, but we're not going to. Okay? But Paul's good news is God is doing something. And he has power. Now, how many tried to walk outside the last couple days and had trouble opening the door? Huh? Does the wind have power? Yeah, I drove by this morning, these portable basketball goals. You know, buy them? They're not made for Kansas. I am sorry. Because 2 days ago, it's standing upright. The guy has piled 4 bags of sand on top of it to keep it from flipping over. Where is it this morning?
Looked
flipped over. I had one down in Texas. It was terrible. I staked that thing down. I filled it with almost concrete and still, wind would hit that backboard and over it'd go. Right? Power. Power to do something. A subject has to have some power. And so he talks about God's righteousness three times. He talks about God's glory. He talks about God's grace. How many of you met Cale in here? Is there a guy named Cale in here? Cale, hi. Would you stand up for a second? Wisconsin Dells, that's cool. Haven't been there. This is Cale. Now, one of the funny things that happens in college is you all come into this class, but you don't know who other people are. Right? Now we look at Cale. He's got a Nike swoosh. The swoosh is the sign of Nike, which is a Greek name for victory. Right? We would assume he's a winning kind of person who runs track because everyone knows Nike shoes are the best track shoes, right? Thank you. Sit down. Okay? Do you run track?
No.
Are you a winning type of guy?
Yeah.
Have you ever lost?
Yeah.
Okay. Just checking. How do we know who Cale is? Cale comes into class, sits down. About the only thing I know about Cale, what he wrote on his little personal information sheet, and the fact that he shows up to class on time. I don't see him out doing anything else. What's he, maybe twice on campus? Yeah. How do I know who Cale is? Because we see the things that Cale does. Now, if I was to observe Cale and something that he did, like, saw him in the library studying. I'd say, Cale's a good student. He's studying. Saw him out on the baseball field throwing a 95-mile-an-hour fastball. You're probably not a pitcher, are you?
Yeah, I am.
You are? Oh, well, cool. Got that one right. You know, 95-mile-an-hour fastball. I'd say, well, he's a baseball player. See him on interview with Sports Illustrated. I'd say, oh, he's doing steroids. That was a little personal humor in here. Right? How do we know who God is? We only know who God is by the things God does. See, God is the subject, and so Paul is going to take this time to talk about what has God done. What's he done? And he describes it, and the good thing is we don't have to get through it all today because we've got 3 days to do this. God is known by his works and deeds. Paul's just talked about humans being known by their works and deeds. See how these tie together? Humans' deeds are bad, not righteous. God's deeds are righteous by definition. So, what does he begin by saying? God is a God of the present. The righteous, this, remember, this is 58. The righteousness of God has been disclosed or revealed, the revelatory nature of the gospel. It's attested by the law and the prophets. God, the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe. But in verse 26, to prove at the present time that he is righteous. Righteous, 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 righteous. Who's God? God is righteous. How? Because he does these righteous things. He does all these things to show who he is, and he is righteous. But mostly he's God of the present. Exegetically speaking, the Romans worshipped, what was their god's name? Jupiter. Right? The Greeks worshipped Zeus. In the first century, do you think they viewed those people as gods of the present? Or the past. How many read Homer? And the Odyssey, the Iliad and the Odyssey. You had to read it at some point in time, right? As written, the events of that are about 1000 BC before Rome even existed. That's our understanding of Greek mythology. We don't know much about Roman mythology because we never read the Aeneid. Anybody read the Aeneid? That was a Latin rewrite. See, Hollywood got its ideas from the Greeks and Romans. You take something in Greek, you rewrite it in Latin, and you show it again and call it something new. Right? Just like Hollywood has these movies and they show them again and just change, they think, oh, wow, this is a whole new movie. Oh, that's cool. And you only know if it's good or not if you saw the previous one. Well, in 58, the gods had done things in the past. They hoped they'd do things in the present. But they really had this classical sense of these are our ancestors and we just need to take care of them. They were god of the past. You move up into the 18th century, the late 17th century, so the late 1600s, the 1700s. You have something taking place in the world. It's called the beginnings of the scientific revolution. Isaac Newton. Anybody heard about Isaac Newton? Went outside under an apple tree. The apple dropped on his head and he said, ah, gravity. Right? How do they view God in that time period? Was God a God of the present or the past? Well, the major philosophical viewpoint on God was called deism. Deism said God created the world, and he set the world in order like a great clock, and the role of humans were to figure out how the clock worked. But God set it in motion and then sat back on a chair to watch and see what would unfold. God was distant and away, not present. See, our view of where God is located has a great deal to do with whether God acts and does things. Paul says God is a God of the present. This is in 58. Even though he's talking about something that happened 28 years ago with the death and resurrection of Jesus, he still considers it to be the present. Why? How many of you have grandparents still alive? Did you talk to them?
Yeah.
That's good. Is when they talk about their early days or when you were just a little baby, which they usually refer to frequently, and how cute you were or not cute you were. Is it something about the past they're describing or something of the present?
No.
Do they view it as the past?
No.
No, it's part of their existence. See, that's the funny thing about the present and past. It's not chronologically based. It's based experientially, the present and the past. And so this God who is righteous and reveals his glory and his grace, who's known by the things that he does, is doing things. He didn't just do things way back then. He's doing things. He's not just going to wait until some far off time. He's doing things. That's Paul's perspective. Good news! Something's happening. We won the Revolutionary War! Good. Only the British are coming. Right? Is that something of the present? We won the Revolutionary War? Doesn't that get you excited? No, why? Because you view it as something of the past. It has nothing to do with the present. Good news, we're not having class tomorrow! Get excited about that? Yes! Why? Because it's in the present. So when Paul says, I'm not ashamed of this gospel, the proclamation, I'm saying God is doing something right now. Now he's talking about 58. I'm not going to be hermeneutical and let you and tell you what it means today. You can decide. But God, Paul's message is God is doing something now in 58. And is present within the human experience. Of all the things that's taking place, God is with us. An important Jewish concept. Do the Romans view the gods as with us? Do the Greeks view the gods as with us? Do the 1700 British view the God as with us? No. The Greeks saw God living up on Mount Olympus. The Greeks lived, technically, for most of you, Italy's a boot. Greeks, this little peninsula comes down, has this island here. Okay. Modern day Greece goes way up here into this area. And we think that it's way up here. They didn't. That was Greece at that point in time. And where's Mount Olympus? It's way up there. They live out there. The gods are out there. The gods are out there. The gods are out there. The Judeo perspective, the Jewish perspective, said God is here with us. It's a different perspective than most of the Gentiles would have been familiar with. But he also wants to say that God's present action is not antithetical to the Torah. He's going to get back to that in chapter 9. How does he do that? Let's see. God has been disclosed and is attested by the law and the prophets. The righteousness of God has now been revealed, now in this present time. But now, and it's attested by the law and the prophets. What's that mean? What's attested to mean? It means it's agreed with. The law and the prophets talked about this righteousness of God. And so what I am saying is not different from what the law says and the prophets say. They also talk about the righteousness of God. One of the earliest heresies in Christianity was in the 2nd century, about 150, there was a gentleman who was raised in the church. His dad was a leader in the church. He moved to Rome, which had a very long... Rome? That's where they wrote this letter to, right? Do you think the church grew in Rome between 58 and 150, over 100 years? Yes. Lots of traditions forming up here, even though the emperor's still around. His name is Marcion. He said, you know what? We don't need the Old Testament. Get rid of it. Does Paul say get rid of the Old Testament? No. He says the Old Testament bears witness to the righteousness of God. And if the gospel is about the righteousness of God, then we need the Old Testament. Funny thing is, Marcion said, you know what? This is what Paul said. Get rid of the Old Testament. Can't believe everything everyone says somebody else said. Helps if you would read them for yourself. Which is why I ask you to read Paul. Because, really? I don't even want you to believe half the words I say, Paul says. I want you to read Paul and see if what I'm saying resonates. Okay? So, what else do we know about God? He's impartial. Really? There is no distinction. I sit here, I look around the room. There's a student who's a religion major and engaged to be married. He's pretty good. I had that student before. Haven't had that one. Shelly's tired all the time, having trouble keeping her eyes open today. Not because I'm boring. She's just tired. I understand that. people sleep not because they're bored, they're tired. Seth's there, talked to him before, okay. A couple of young ladies I've had interaction with, all right. People sit on the front two rows I like a lot. People sitting on the back row I don't like very much. So, okay, I'm impartial, right? No. I'm impartial? No. I'm partial. You're partial. But what about God? Is he partial? Does he like the Jews more than the Gentiles? If you're a Jew, you say, yeah! Just like you sit in the front two rows. You go, yeah, I'm going to get an A because he likes people sitting in the front two rows. Is God partial? Does he prefer the Jews over the Gentiles? Think the Jews liked hearing that? God is impartial? How do we summarize Paul's argument in three simple lines? God is one, monotheistic. There is only one God. And he is the God of the Jews and the Gentiles. And God is fair. He's not partial. He treats the Jew and the Gentile the same to the Jew and the Gentile. There's no distinction. God is not partial. Now, the Jews would say, that's not good. Gentiles say, that's good for us. And this gift, somehow, must be through faith. They are justified by His grace as a gift. Saturday. It's a special day. It's Valentine's Day. Tim, are you excited about the gift you're going to get? Mark? Daniel? Josh? Shelly? No gifts? Jessica?
I have to work.
You have to work? No gift on Saturday? You're not going to get anything?
I hope so, but...
Ellen, are you excited? Yeah, Ellen's excited. Because Paul's a great guy. I've only met him 3 times, but he's got to be great. Ellen likes him, right? You have to work?
Yeah.
Where do you work?
Bonefish Grill.
Bonefish Grill. So somebody's going to give you a tip?
No, I'm going to be running food, which means I don't have my own table.
You don't get a tip?
No.
Oh, man. You get any money at all?
Yeah, I'll get paid by the hour.
Get paid by the hour because you're working.
Well, I'll get off early because I traded to be a food server and speaker instead of a server. So that's a gift.
That's a gift. No, it's not a gift. It's an exchange. You still have to work early. So you're going to get paid,
yes.
Right? So if somebody comes up and says, man, you did a great job of running food and here's $50, that would be pay? But it would be pay?
It would be a gift.
It would be a gift. See, there's a difference between gifts and wages. Legalism says God has to pay me. I did what was right. God has to pay me. Covenantal gnomism says God has to treat me right because I'm doing exactly what I'm supposed to do. Both of them, you earn exactly what you get. Paul says, this is a gift. This righteousness of God, whatever that means, because we haven't gotten to it yet, is a gift. Who's giving it? God is giving it. That's the good news that Paul has to say. There's a gift on the way. A gift has already been given. And he thinks that's good news. Kind of interesting. Now it's through faith, and that introduces a whole new ballgame that we don't even want to get to at this point in time. So we'll just say, we'll pick up there on Friday. Please bring your notebooks, flats,
Not in binders, not in three-ring binders. Oh, yeah, another thing I haven't mentioned. Some people turn in all their notes. They stick their notes in there. I don't get it back to you on Monday. Well, we don't have class on Monday. I won't even get it back to you on Wednesday. So don't put your notes in there or else you won't have them when you turn them in. Just a word to the wise. We'll see you on Friday.